football game was played at the Polo Grounds in 1908. Between the Giants and the Cubs one day, and sealed the Giants' fate. They had the game in their hands all right, with a man on first and third. Then a hit brought in the tally to win, but Myrtle's brain was blurred.
Did he run?
It's 1:07 Central Time. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Our producer for the program today, Harriet Williamson. The technical director is Jason Croft. That song you just heard was Did He Run, as performed by the Peerless Quartet with Frank Stanley on lead vocals. That's a recording from 1909. The verse you heard makes reference to a key moment in the history of the Chicago Cubs, a game between the Cubs and New York Giants in 1908. The song was written by Albert von Tilzer. It concerns a shortstop for the 1908 Giants named Fred Merkle, who would be remembered forever for a base-running blunder that ended up forcing another game with the Cubs, who went on to the World Series that year against Detroit. Of course, that's the last Cubs World Series championship. And we'll get to that moment a few minutes later in the show. Today's guest is Kate Murphy. She's the assistant managing editor of Fortune magazine in New York. She's also written for The Economist in London and Wall Street Journal Asia. But she's also a former softball player at Amherst College, and she's with us today to discuss turn-of-the-century baseball, Crazy 08, how a cast of cranks, rogues, boneheads, and magnates created the greatest year in baseball history. That's her book. Good afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Draws the assistant managing editor of something entirely different, Fortune magazine, to write about baseball in the early 1900s.
Well, first, let me just say, I loved that song, which I quote in the book, but I had never actually heard it before, so that was a great treat for me. And to answer your question, I like to say, well, I've been a baseball fan longer than I've been a business journalist, and so this was actually a natural fit for me. I grew up sort of drinking in baseball, as many of us learn, you know, at my father's side. And in about 2003, when I decided to write a book, looking into baseball was a natural place for me to seek an idea. And in fact, it was my father who said something to the effect, you know, Kate, I think 1908 was a pretty interesting season. Why don't you look into that? And I did. And I realized that not only was it what I consider the best season in baseball history, and there are people who disagree with me, but I just like to say that they're wrong and I'm right. But it was also a very interesting time in American history. And so one of the things I try to do in Crazy 08 is to show what the America of 1908 was like, as well as what baseball in 1908 was like.
Did your upbringing, was your family, you know, big baseball fans, and your allegiance to a particular team draw you closer to this? Or?
Well, my father was a very big baseball fan, and he grew up in Chicago a couple long fly balls from Wrigley Field. And his first job was wiping down the streets, the seats at Wrigley, and his upstairs neighbor was the great Hall of Fame catcher, Gabby Hartnett. So, as a boy, Dad's family moved to New Rochelle, New York, which is a suburb of New York City, and he transferred his allegiance to the Giants, and then when they left New York, became a Mets fan. So I grew up a Mets fan, but I have a lot of affection for the Cubs as well.
So what sets the season apart from anything else in that era?
Okay, well, for one thing, let's start with the song, which commemorates what I think most baseball people still consider the most controversial play in baseball history, and that's the story of poor Fred Merkle, who as a 19-year-old rookie, having hit a crucial hit, is standing on first base, there's a teammate on third, two outs, bottom of the ninth, and the batter, a guy named Al Bridwell, a tie score, hits a clean single. The runner at third scampers home, and Fred Merkle sees that the runner has scored. And this happened in the Polo Grounds in New York, and people would exit through the outfield. So you had 20,000 fans just streaming onto the field in joy, but also just to leave the ballpark, Fred Merkel turns and just lights off for the clubhouse. He doesn't touch second base. The Cubs second baseman, Johnny Evers, of Tinker to Evers to Chance fame, gets a ball. By no means clear it was the actual game ball. Touches second and screams at the umpire. Merkel never touched second. He's out. The run don't score. And after some consultation, the umpires agree. You know, technically this was the case. So they call Merkel out. It's the third out of the inning. The run doesn't score, and it's declared a tie game. 2 weeks later, at the end of the season, the Giants and the Cubs have identical records, and they have to replay the Merkel game for the pennant. So, you know, a very controversial play. And, of course, these days we're used to being able to get six different replays from different camera angles, you know, within seconds. And, of course, in those days you couldn't do that. So it's still a sort of hotly contested thing. So the most controversial play in baseball history, two of the best pennant races, both pennant races went down to the last day. In both leagues, three teams were in contention with 2 days left. And the only other seasons that come close to that are 1949 and 1964. It's also the first generation of the really iconic baseball heroes. Christy Mathewson has his best season, as does Honus Wagner. Cy Young has his last good season. Walter Johnson has his first good season. Ty Cobb is in his third full season and is established as a superstar. So all these very iconic names are at or near the peaks of their careers. You had a perfect game pitched in the white heat of a pennant race. And you also had a lot of odd, funny things, which is why I call the book Crazy 08. You know, in spring training, a train breaks down 30 miles from Mobile, Alabama, and the team is stranded. A plague of gnats descends on a game with the Giants. The Washington Senators fans give their manager a wolf as a gift. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And finally, I think it's a turning point in baseball history. I think this is the year that baseball grew up, in part because of the Merkel game, which revealed the sort of frailties of management. And most concretely, quite literally, is ground is broken on the first modern baseball stadium, which opens in 1909, and that's Scheib Park in Philadelphia. So that's my case.
We've already got a caller on the line. We'd welcome your questions for Kate Murphy about early baseball in the 1900s at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Caller on line four from Hoopston. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Fascinating show. I don't often get a chance to say this, but Kate, I actually have your book, and it's a fascinating read, and it's taking me through a delightful baseball season this year. Actually grew up on the South Side, but I'm a diehard Cubs fan. I'm tormented probably for the rest of my life.
It must be a tough life for you sometimes.
Yes, it's been a tough 100 years or whatever. Just two quick points, and then I'll go ahead and ring off. The West Side Park in Chicago, going to school at UIC, I want to say it was originally at Wood and Polk Street, which is now the site of the UIC Medical School.
That's correct.
If memory stands correct.
Yeah.
But one aside from your book, actually, which I just found unbelievable, was the idea of returning the foul balls. In your book, you said the umpire was given three. They were given three balls. I think today you said something like we go through 80 or 90 balls.
Yeah.
But case in point is this turned around, I believe, in your book, it's in 1923. They wanted to prosecute an 11-year-old boy for actually keeping one of the foul balls.
Correct.
And I just, I don't know, maybe if you want to expound on that, but I just thought that was amazing, an idea compared with, obviously, today where we are. But anyway, I just wanted to say that it's a fascinating book, and I appreciate it, and I'm enjoying the show. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for calling and for the kind words. The caller is correct. In 1908, when a ball is hit into the stands, the fan is required to return the ball. And they will, in fact, have policemen, you know, get the ball from the fan, or if the fan refuses, arrest the fan. In spring training in 1908, the Giants are losing so many balls in the stands that McGraw, the manager, does call in the cops to enforce the law. And Christy Mathewson, the great pitcher, He fingers one guy to the cops, which I don't think is very nice. The owners at the time were extremely cheap, and this is simply one of the ways that that manifests themselves. Now, for your and as the caller also noted, in 1908, the Cubs played on the west side. We think of them as a north side team now, but they played on the west side, now on the side of what is the University of Illinois Medical Center. And I was giving a talk in Chicago a couple months ago, and I said, I went to, walk the neighborhood when I was researching the book, and I was shocked and appalled that there was no historical marker noting that this was the area in which the Cubs won their only World Series. And a guy immediately shot up his hand, and there is apparently an effort to put a statue, I believe, at the corner of Polk and Lincoln of Tinker, Evers, and Chance. And there's a fundraising effort going on. They're about halfway through, and I just thought that was an interesting nugget.
You mentioned Tinker, Evers, and Chance already, giving the story about Fred Merkel, and they were well known as this double play combination, but they didn't turn this record number of double plays or anything like that. I guess they just played together for a while.
That's right. But the thing you have to remember about Tinker, Evers, and Chance is, if you look at the numbers, no, they didn't turn all that many double plays. The fact is, on teams with good pitching, you never turn that many double plays because you're not to have people on base. And the Cubs had one of the great pitching staffs in history. But I think what can be said about them is that when they needed to turn a double play, they were very capable of it. Their peers regarded them as the best infield in the game. And so, 99 years later, their statistics don't look very good. But I think you have to look at contemporary opinion to really gauge how good they were. And I think they were very, very good. That said, I still don't think Evers or Tinker belong in the Hall of Fame.
And they didn't like each other.
Couldn't stand each other. I think it was probably one of those things that they were too much alike. They were both, Evers was incredibly high-strung, and at one point, actually, I think in 1911, had a nervous breakdown, which I think was utterly unsurprising to those who knew and loved him. He was extremely high-strung. But Tinker was a very sensitive soul as well, and so you know what it's like when you get two sensitive people in highly charged circumstances. You can set each other off the wrong way, and they were not exactly quick to forgive each other either. The story ever says that Tinker threw a ball at him and broke his finger and laughed. And Tinker says Evers once took a cab and didn't invite his teammates to join him. Who knows? But the fact is, these were sensitive people, ungiven to humility and apology, and they rubbed each other the wrong way. But I liked what Evers said. He said, we hated each other, but we loved the Cubs, and that was enough. And they did reconcile in about 1936-37.
You talked about a few players. Let's talk about ownership. There were efforts shortly before this season to get a different kind of union agreements. I know Andrew Freeman, who was one of the owners of the Giants, tried to set up a baseball syndicate.
Right. This had happened a couple years before, and this is one of the reasons why, even though I wrote a book which is largely about baseball, I tried to bring in the other currents of happening in America at the time. Before the American League was established as a major league, which happened in 1903, the baseball was a monopoly. You had one league, Major League Baseball was a monopoly. You had one league, the National League, and they repelled anyone who tried to enter or to set up an alternative league. It was a trust. And this was the era, both when trusts were most dominant in the American economy, and yet also the era when they were beginning to be challenged, the first term of President Roosevelt. And so baseball was caught sort of on the cusp of that. It was a monopoly. It was a trust. The American League decides to challenge it. And eventually the National League had the American League in, not only because the American League was a strong entrant, but because the tenor of the times had moved against them with the trust busting. But before that happened, this very awful owner of the New York Giants, who alienated absolutely everyone, he wanted to create an even closer monopoly in which all the players would be pooled, and all the revenues would be pooled, and then each team would get a share of the profits, with the New York team getting the most, of course. And through a series of highly dubious parliamentary subterfuges, his scheme was defeated. But it just shows sort of what the thinking of the owners was at the time, and really what American business was like at the time.
I think at one point there was a comparison made in the book between what a ball player made at that time compared to a teacher. I think it was in Chicago. I mean,
that's right.
What was the market like for what could a decent ball player expect to make at that time?
The average salary for a ball player in 1908 was about $2,500, which sounds farcical now. But as I point out in the book, a school teacher in Chicago with I think 6 years' experience would make about $850. So you're making triple an experienced teacher. And for a lot of baseball players, that was a very, very good wage, more than they could have commanded on their other skills. So they were well paid by 1908 standards. Nothing like today's players, of course. But a lot of the players were from very humble backgrounds. You know, Johnny Evers worked in a collar factory. A number of them were from small farms and so on. And so this was a high profitable experience for them.
And baseball became more of a college educated game in the early 1900s. You pointed out as the century started, there were more and more well educated men that decided to pursue a career in baseball.
Yes, that's one of the myths of what is known as the dead ball era, which is regarded as being from 1901 to 1919. One of the stereotypes is that the players were sort of ignorant louts, not accepted in polite society. By 1908, that's really not true. About a quarter of the players have some college education, and that's compared to 5% of society at large. So, you know, that's almost five times as many, you know, per capita in the major leagues as in society. And so that, you know, that's a substantial difference. And the reason that this happened... Oh, and in fact, further research has shown that baseball players, on the whole, were from more educated, more middle-class homes than society as a whole. Now, that said, a lot of the players were from very humble backgrounds, but again, you have to look at that in the context of society. In 1908, the average American had 6 years of education and would live to be about 50 years old. It was only in 1910... that you had equilibrium between city and country. And so this is obviously the pool from which baseball draws its players. It also reflects, however, that baseball had gotten much more respectable. In the 1890s, it went through a stage in which it was something like the equivalent of roller derby. You know, if you were a respectable person, you wouldn't bring your date, you wouldn't bring your mother. It was becoming something that sort of loutish young men went to. And largely with the emergence of the American League, baseball management began to crack down on, you know, crudeness on the field and in the stands. And by 1908, going to a ball game is something you can bring a date to. And in fact, you look at the pictures, it's maybe 10% women. In fact, it's interesting, 1908 is the year that baseball's anthem is written, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." Now, when we go to the ball game, we sing the chorus, but there's actually verses, and the verses have to do with a young woman named Katie Casey, who had baseball fever and had it bad, and when her beau said, "Let's go to a show," she said, "Take me out to the ball game." And what's interesting about that is that the main character is a woman. It's Katie Casey, and it didn't strike anyone as odd at the time, in 1908, that you could write a baseball song about a woman fan. And that just sort of showed how baseball had really earned respectability and popularity.
And tickets were what, about 25 cents?
25 cents for the cheap seats, 50 for the expensive one. And you'll read in the newspapers about scalpers were getting $5, $7 a ticket.
You mentioned the tradition of the seventh inning stretch, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." Star Spangled Banner wasn't even sung before games until around World War I.
That's correct. It was occasionally done, but it was a big sense of occasion. It might be done on opening day. It might be done if they're having one of these celebrations. One of the nice things about baseball in this era is that every once in a while they'd say, well, let's have Honus Wagner Day. He's having a heck of a year. And so they'd have Honus Wagner Day, and they'd give him some, you know, some trophy, and the fans would chip in and buy him a watch, and people would give him speeches. So maybe something like a Honus Wagner Day. Cy Young had a day in Boston in 1908. But it was actually, it was with World War One, with the heightened patriotic feelings that going to that war evoked, that it became routine.
You, in your book, you have these little timeout sections that sort of offshoot related subjects to the baseball in that year. And one, you talk about there was a commission formed to determine just how American the game was, and I guess the nationalities of who made up the team.
Right. Well, the ethnicity of baseball players in 1908 was not that diverse. A lot of ethnic Irish, a lot of ethnic German, typically not people who were immigrants themselves, but were sons of immigrants. That was true both of Honus Wagner, for example, the son of German immigrants, Johnny Evers, the son of Irish immigrants, and then, of course, native-born Americans, who were the majority. A couple of Italians, but that was basically it. No African Americans, of course. But the Mills Commission had a slightly different mandate. The Al Spalding, who founded the Spalding Sporting Goods Company, and had been a great Major League Baseball player in his time, considered himself a patriotic American, and he, for some reason, was immensely distressed when people like Henry Chadwick, who was an English immigrant, who became the first full-time baseball writer, would make the perfectly reasonable case that baseball was descended from an English child's game known as rounders. And so Spalding put together the Mills Commission, he called it, named after its chief, Abraham Mills, who happened to be a crony of Spalding's. And he told the Mills Commission, you go off and you determine the origins of baseball. Which sounds fair enough, but really the unstated agenda was to, and you come back with an answer that I like. And sure enough, they did. A couple years into their researches, which were not vigorous by any means, they get a letter from a guy named Abner Graves, who grew up in Cooperstown, New York. And Mr. Graves at this point is in his late 70s, perhaps early 80s, and he vividly remembers a day in 1839 when Abner Doubleday scratched out a diamond in the dirt at Finney's Field and sort of created the game of baseball. Well, this is just the kind of thing the commission was looking for. I mean, Cooperstown is a gorgeous village. Abner Doubleday was a Union war hero during the Civil War. He was also conveniently dead, so he couldn't contradict anything Mr. Graves said. So the commission, on the basis of two letters from Abner Graves, and two letters that contradicted themselves in numerous ways, declared Cooperstown the birthplace of baseball. And it's utter rubbish, utter rubbish. The only good effect is that's the reason the Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown, and you just couldn't think of a nicer place for it.
Yeah, I was about to say there's a lot to discredit this the Abner Doubleday creation, as at one time he's so supposedly founded baseball.
Oh, there's no way. I mean, the summer he was supposed to have founded baseball, he was a cadet at West Point. And, and you don't leave West Point to go off and play kids' games back home. He was also 15 years older than Abner Graves. They were not playmates. Doubleday never mentions baseball in his 69 diaries. I mean, it never happened. But for some reason, it was important to Spalding, and not Spalding alone, that this game be exclusively American. And I think now we're much more comfortable with the idea that actually to be American is to be the product of all kinds of different influences. This is actually what, in a number of ways, is the most American thing. But for Spalding, you couldn't be derived from someplace else, as most Americans were and are. It had to be completely and exclusively American. And again, that actually says something interesting and important, I think, about the America at the time.
We're talking with Kate Murphy about her book, Crazy 08. And we'll welcome your calls if you'd like to find out a little more about the 1908 baseball season, the last season the Cubs won the World Series. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 are the numbers. Let's get back on the field. Another thing you talked about, the start of the show, you talked about the game growing up. I mean, aside from some rule changes here and there, and when you mentioned the thing about fans not being able to keep foul balls, we're still playing essentially the same game we were playing back then.
Yeah, that's very much the case. And the way I like to put it is this. If you went to a baseball, to a football or a basketball game, if you were to be able to look at a game from that year, the game would look bizarre. I mean, the play would look really unskilled. You wouldn't understand a lot of the strategies. It would look like a complete, it would not look familiar. But if you could take yourself out to a ball game in 1908, there was almost nothing going on that you wouldn't completely understand. I mean, there are some cosmetic differences, obviously, the way people dressed. There's whiskey sold in the stands and pig's knuckles in Cincinnati. The fields are much bigger, but the actual game is almost identical. The big changes being the abolition of freak pitches in 1920 and the institution of the designated hitter rule, which I fervently oppose, in 1973. And in a way, when you think about it, that makes sense. Alexander Joy Cartwright is given credit for being the first person to write down the rules of baseball, and he did that in 1845. So by 1908, you'd had three generations of play. And so the baseball was actually very refined by 1908, and you and I could have a ball going to a 1908 ball game. It would we would be very, very familiar.
Who made up the earliest rivalries? A lot of cities, a lot of towns have changed cities. Teams have changed cities, and some don't exist anymore.
Right. Baseball, you know, because of the traveling constraints, obviously there was no air travel in 1908. So you had to travel by train, and so that constrains the geographic range of the teams. The southernmost team was St. Louis, which had two teams, the Browns in the American League and the Cardinals in the National League, and the furthest north was Detroit. And then Boston had two teams, as did Philadelphia, and then New York had three, two in Manhattan, one in Brooklyn, and they traveled by train. The biggest rivalry in 1908 was clearly the New York Giants and the Chicago Cubs. And so that's another reason why the Merkle play was so resonant. You know, it happened in the pennant race between these two teams that genuinely didn't like each other. Now, I don't know how you feel about the Yankees. I'm not in favor of them, but I think today you'd have to concede the most intense baseball rivalry is Yankees-Red Sox. I think the Cubs-Giants of a century ago was actually much more intense. I think there was genuine personal dislike among the teams. You know, as you recall, Johnny Damon went from the Red Sox to the Yankees a couple of years ago, and people sort of shrugged. I can't imagine any player on these two teams voluntarily switching to the other. And so it must have really, you know, been something to behold.
I'm a Cub fan, by the way.
Okay.
From Chicago area.
Okay.
So. And a couple of these the teams that we now recognize as really being dominant. You mentioned the Yankees that year. They were called the New Highlanders, or right before in that era, mm-hmm. and they were awful, I believe, in 1908.
Oh, they were absolutely rotten. The name of Yankees was already emerging. Their official or quasi-official name was the Highlanders when they were founded in 1903. But already, again, if you look at the contemporaneous newspapers, they were becoming known as the Yankees, I think chiefly because it's shorter, and so it fits into headlines better. But the 1908 Yankees were the second-worst Yankee team in history. Only the 1912 version was worse. They were in last place, and I think the Washington Senators were in seventh place, and the Yankees were 17 games behind them. I mean, they were just rotten. And what was so kind of interesting about this is before the season, you know, people looked at their lineup and said, you know, this is going to be a terrific team. And a lot of people picked them to win the American League. And indeed, as of June 1st, they were in first place. And then it all just fell apart. It must have been almost unbelievable to watch. And by September, August, September, they're clearly basically not even trying. Now, why did this happen? Hard to say. Sports writers of that era were essentially wholly owned subsidiaries of the team. Their travel expenses were paid for by the teams, and in response, they gave quite a bit of loyalty. They didn't tell a lot of stuff that they knew. But I suspect one of the reasons has to have been the presence of Hal Chase. Are you familiar with him?
Just what I've read in the book.
Yeah. Hal Chase was widely regarded, and for decades after he retired, as the finest fielding first baseman of his time, and maybe of all time. He was a handsome, strapping fellow from California, and he came east in 1904 as a much ballyhooed rookie. I mean, he could have really been the toast of New York. I mean, he was that good, that handsome, that engaging, and the fact is the man was as crooked as a $3 bill. And he's pretty much regarded as the most dishonest player in baseball history. And the evidence is, I wouldn't call it decisive, but it's suggestive, and given the way his career played out, I kind of believe it. I think he started throwing games in 1908, and as you can imagine, that just kills team morale. You know, he might have brought in other teammates on his schemes, and anyway, the Yankees went under and then kept digging. I have half a chapter on the Yankees of 1908, and I'll admit I took great glee in writing this, because I really don't like the Yankees.
Well, I've got the final standings here from 1908, and I guess much to the pleasure of Cub fans, the Cardinals were a disastrous 49-105 that year, the last in the National League.
Oh, the Cardinals were an amazingly wretched team. I mean, they had 100 more errors than any other team. They scored 372 runs the entire season. And that's a record that will never be broken. They had one terrific and interesting pitcher, a guy named Arthur or Bugs Raymond. He was their best pitcher, and he went 15-25 that year. And yet, he was a terrific pitcher. 11 times he pitched, and the Cardinals were shut out, and I think another dozen times they only scored one run. So the joke is it would drive a man to drink. But unfortunately, Bugs Raymond was a raging, raging alcoholic. And again, this is a time when the sports writers are very circumspect about the players. And yet, Bugs Raymond is so drunk so often, so vividly, so publicly, that even they can't quite ignore it, and it's widely known that he is an intense alcoholic. Raymond is actually traded to the Giants for the 1909 season, and McGraw, who sort of thought he had a gift with hard cases, tried to straighten him out, but it just didn't work. And very tragically, in 1911, Bugs Raymond died in a drunken brawl. But he was their best player, by far.
Let's talk about drinking in the game. I mean, you had a lot of players who admitted to being inebriated, probably during games and plenty off the field.
There were certainly plenty off the field. I don't know much about on the field. Baseball as a professional game was also pretty well established by 1908. And remember, too, for a lot of the players, they're making more money in baseball than they're going to be able to do when they have to, go back home, or they'll be, tending bar or working in a factory. So the evidence is more that they, on the whole, as is today, that they took the game very professionally. And on-field drinking, maybe it happened, maybe, it could still happen in the dog days. It certainly wasn't a common thing. Off the field, yeah, I think there was quite a bit of drinking, and I suspect there might be a little bit now as well. It was a hard drinking time. But is it massively different than in subsequent years? It's hard to say, again, because we the sports writers don't tell us. But we do know that they're young men spending a lot of time away from home. And then and now and probably forevermore, that's a kind of recipe for a lot of drinking.
Well, one thing that did take place, though, you're not going to see at ball games now, or fans throwing a lot of things from the stands, vegetables, glass, you know. I mean, I know that you had a couple instances of ball players and managers maybe and umpires get hurt by stuff being thrown out from the stands.
Yes. The in 1908, this was a real problem. And again, the owners, who are really a deeply unimpressive group of people, do not take action to stop because they think the fans will not come to the park or they'll be unhappy. But the fans didn't like a play. They'd throw pop bottles, and you know, think of like a bottle of Coke or something, except the glass was much heavier in those days. And in 1907, a fan hurls one at an umpire and fractures his skull. I mean, this is there's nothing funny about this. There's nothing, you know, jovial or acceptable about this. But it did become part of going to the ballpark among a group of fans, and there was nothing done to stop it. Eventually, I don't know exactly when, maybe in the 20s or something, the owners took some action. But this was a real problem. Now, that said, sometimes things were done in fun. Like, if you made a great play, people might throw you hats. There was one guy who hit a fabulous home run, and he was cigars rained down on him. He happened to be a non-smoker, unfortunately. But so there was some fun to it. But sort of plague of pop bottles and balls and missiles of all kinds. It was a real issue.
Let's talk about fan allegiance and how it took a while for fans to warm to the team. I guess particularly let's talk about the Cubs. I know at one point in the season there were times where fans were applauding, you know, great plays made by the opposition.
I have to say, when I was doing the research and reading a lot of old sports pages, and I remember the first time I came across this, I thought, well, you know, that's odd. And then I came across it again and again and again. And my theory, for which I really have no evidence, is simply that team sports they're developed. Baseball as a team sport is developed, but as being sort of an extension of city loyalty, it's still sort of a new idea. They just kind of don't have the hang of it yet. And so that's why, so they weren't quite as chauvinistic or as partisan as we kind of expect people to be at, say, Wrigley Field or wherever today. I mean, there is something kind of sweet about it, but I actually think a lot of the fun of going to the ballpark is, you know, rooting for your team. And, you know, I can appreciate a good play, but, you know, I'm darned if I'm going to cheer for it if the wrong people do it. But it does, again, it just shows that this is still an evolving sport and the culture is still evolving. I was very struck by that myself.
I've got with me, actually, a sports page from September 24th, 1908. Talked a little bit about the major game play the day before.
Yeah.
What I wanted to talk about, though, is there's an ad here from that at Orchestra Hall you can watch the Tribune electric scoreboard, where you could see, I guess, sort of a very early version of the webcast you would bring up if you can't watch your game on TV.
Well, yes, this was a fascinating thing, and something I had no idea of before I began working on this book. So 1908, radio is in its infancy, so ball games are not being broadcast. The first baseball broadcast, I think, is 1929. Obviously, there's no TV. Not everyone can get to the park or, you know, maybe afford tickets. So how can you get news of the ball game? And so one solution was as follows, and this was done in the cities all over the country. Often newspapers would sponsor them. So the we'll specifically talk about Orchestra Hall, which I believe was sponsored by the Chicago Tribune, get these massive, think of a really massive board game in the shape of a baseball diamond with the outfield, say maybe 6 feet by 6 feet on the sides of the diamonds. And then down one side, you have the names of the players, each team. And at each position on the diamond, there's a light bulb at each base. At each position. And then you have just a scoreboard, you know, how many runs in what innings, how many hits to the right. So if you can visualize that, you would have a telegrapher at the ballpark and one, you know, next to this big board game. So the telegrapher at the ballpark would wire news of what's happening at the ball game to the one at Orchestra Hall. And then that person tells the board operator. So let's say Frank Chance is at bat and there's a man on first. Frank Chance hits a ball to the pitcher who throws to second base, who throws to first. The board would show the batter light going on, then the pitcher, then second base, then first base. And then if there was an out, there would be an X on the base. And then it would also be recorded, the ball, strikes, and outs on the side. So the idea was that you could visually follow pitch by pitch what was happening at the game. And I'm not convinced I did a good job of explaining that, but I hope people can visualize what it was like. You had a series of lights representing the play on the field, and it was pitch by pitch.
And you had to pay the same as if you were attending the game itself, this little ad.
Okay, the one at Orchestra Hall was a pay for your seat. I think it was 25 cents. All that went to charity. The more typical thing, though, was that newspaper offices or department stores would set up these boards just in the windows or even on the street. So, for example, in New York, there was one set up, I think, outside the New York Herald's office on Lower Broadway. And there's these fabulous pictures of Broadway just black with people. Black with people all around the scoreboards. And then there was another one up by the Polo Grounds in Upper Manhattan. So more typically, it was a free thing. You'd be on the street. But the Orchestra Hall was for charity, so they charged.
Real quick, do you want to place any predictions on modern-day baseball with this postseason?
I don't know about predictions, but I'd love to see the Cubs in the postseason. And your listeners might not like this. I'd like to see another Mets-Red Sox World Series.
Well, if the Cubs can't make the World Series, maybe we can. Maybe the Red Sox can get their revenge on the 86 game.
Well, that's not what I want either, but we'll work with it.
All right. Kate Murphy has been our guest. We've been talking about Crazy 08, how a cast of cranks, rogues, boneheads, and magnates created the greatest year in baseball history. It's published by Smithsonian Books. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.